Alfonso, I would ask, like, do you have an additional room or an unoccupied room or a space that they can maybe go and do their work and other activities just temporarily while you do this?
Yeah, but then we're putting one half of our staff on one quarter of our students.
In that classroom, you mean, right?
Yeah.
Well, theoretically, you were already working 1-on-5 until you got Carolyn, right?
Yeah.
So now you'd be working 1-on-4 with Carolyn or the teacher being 1-on-1. So you actually just improved your ratio, and you were able to get intensive 1-on-1 intervention going on. So you're actually better off now.
Hey, did you know you can actually earn BACBCUs if you're listening to this episode? If you'd like to learn more, including about our Behavior Analyst Certification Board CEUs, that is continuing education units for people that hold the credentials by the BACB, you can go to explanatoryfiction.com and find this episode. Welcome to Explanatory Fiction. It's very important that you know how this podcast is structured. We've randomly generated this case. The variables are entirely fictional. That's right, because with the power of math and science, you can actually do these things now. In fact, the name Fabio Zavala was randomly generated too. And the episode art, you guessed it, also made by artificial intelligence. But the best part is our team is real and the conversations that ensue are designed as a game that you get to play along with us. In each episode, we have one person that is evaluating the case from a clinical decision-making model, and the others are accomplices of mine who are trying to stump the analyst. Our challenge to you is, can you figure out a possible treatment model before us? Here we go. Fabio Zavala is an 8-year-old Hispanic male with severe intellectual disability, autism spectrum disorder, and a traumatic brain injury that resulted from a prenatal car accident. He lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico with his family and attends a public school where he just received a 1-on-1 aid in an intervention classroom. The intervention specialist, Neville, has worked with a similar case before, so the school principal, Alfonso, placed Fabio in there with the aid. After 2 quick weeks in the classroom, everyone is struggling with behavior management due to Fabio's strong need for constant physical contact. If they're not careful, he will engage in elopement to preferred adults, climb on furniture, and engage in self-injurious behavior. Classroom staff are really struggling to have the time that they need for themselves and to provide to other students in this self-contained classroom. You've been scheduled to conduct a classroom observation in the school because they just cannot figure out where to start. Fabio is just constantly on the hip of his mother, his teacher, his aide, everyone, every environment. So, Dimitri, you pull up to the school in your 2012 Toyota Corolla, chug your morning coffee, and head into the school to sign in, where you're welcomed at the front desk.
Welcome to Desert Pines Elementary. Who are you here to see?
Hi, my name's Dimitri McCready, so I'm a behavior analyst. I'm here to do an observation with Fabio.
The principal, Alfonso, mentioned you would be in early. He said it's up to you who you want to see first. So we have Neville, the intervention specialist, Alfonso, the principal, or Carolyn, which is Fabio's aide.
Are one of them available right now?
Yeah, actually, Neville is available, so let's start there, and I'll also send the principal down your way.
Wonderful. Okay.
Oh, by the way, there will be an afternoon meeting with all of you, but Fabio's mother or father cannot make it, so you will be able to talk with everyone here at the school at the end. Mom provided us with written consent for you to be present, and the discussion to happen today among you all. Students will arrive here soon. Let me know if you need anything.
Hi, Neville. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Dimitri. What? Thanks for coming in. So the guy we're going to talk about today, his name is Fabio, and this is actually the second year that I've been working with him. When he comes in with his aide, you're going to see that this guy is just kind of constantly on us. Okay. He is, there's always physical contact. He's 8 years old. He has like no communication for the most part. We've been working on pecs a little bit, but he doesn't really look at them or tell the difference between them.
I'm sorry, when you say no communication, does that mean no overt, like no language? Or, I mean, does he point you to places that he wants? Is he able in any way, shape, or form to like to exchange information that you guys can?
He'll lead you to some stuff, but for the most part, we're just kind of offering him some options and he'll point to one of his options if like we're offering snacks or whatever. But he doesn't tell us when he needs anything. And he doesn't really use
his. And he won't go get it on his own because he's just attached to you?
Yeah, most of the stuff is kind of up in cabinets. He has some snacks in like a little 3-drawer bin near his little hammock chair over there.
Okay.
He has autism, and he had a TBI before he was born. I think it was like his mom was in a car accident or something. So he's pretty low academically. And to be honest, until we got his aid, he was basically on my lap the entire time. And I have four other students in this classroom, so it was kind of he and I were basically attached at the hip, and it made doing things in here pretty challenging. I guess the reason that they've kind of called you in here is because, well, you can kind of see if you look around the room, we can't really have desks or anything in here because he'll just climb them, and then we have to go and, well, it's me, I have to go and pick him up, and then he's just kind of on me, and it became an issue, so it was easier for us to just not have those around, and the other kids do pretty good with their carpet squares.
Oh, and they each get their little carpet squares. They can have a little area to sit while you guys are doing your lessons.
They have a really good morning routine. Yeah. Yeah.
But no matter what, Fabio is attached to the hip, just there clinging, very clingy.
He'll hang out in his hammock chair. That's pretty much the only time that he's not right up on us, or, if he's snacking, he might like chill and hang out. But other than that, he's pretty much on us.
What precipitates him going and leaving from the hammock chair? Let's just say hypothetically, he comes in the morning, goes straight to the hammock chair. What happens that makes him go from sitting in the hammock chair to come engage you and then start the latch on?
Yeah, we're trying to use timers. So like when his time, we'll use that for like a reward, and his timer goes off, and we'll try to get him out of the chair and come over and do some work over. Like his aide Carolyn, we'll have him come over and do some work. So yeah, it's. Basically, like, well, the timer will go off, we'll have him come over, we'll try to use his like a little schedule, and we'll try to have him do a few activities, and then he can earn some more time in the chair, or he'll earn some like some snacks, or that's pretty much it. That's pretty much most of what he likes.
Okay. I'm sorry, let me backtrack. That's great. Thanks. That's good information for what he likes. What I'm really thinking about is, what are the conditions that make him go from not clinging to you guys to clinging to you guys?
It's pretty much he's always clinging to us. And then if we try
Hold on. You just said that he'll sometimes go and hang out and chill in his hammock chair, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So is that just one of those things where he's like tired and he's going to go take a nap? And then if he's awake, he's clinging to you guys? Or does he go in there, chill, kind of do his own thing, and then for whatever reason he comes out and that becomes clinging? So that's what I'm trying to understand. Like what is the precipitating reality factor? What makes it switch from chill mode to get out of the hammock and come get you guys?
I don't really know if there's any like big events. Maybe it's like probably if he just gets bored of it, because he'll sit there and swing for a long time sometimes if other kids are playing and he's just chilling.
Okay. And so then, it's more like idle hands. He does it for a while, but eventually it just seems like he just gets bored, satiated, or whatever.
Yeah.
And he starts hunting for something to do. And when he's hunting for something to do, he's on you guys.
Yeah. More just hunting for that one of us, like one of the grownups in here.
Got it. Okay. That's good. So you had mentioned in your inquiry that sometimes he'll engage in self-injurious behavior and some property destruction stuff and get kind of like maybe throw items in the classroom. Could you mind? So if, let's just say if a zero is him hanging out in the hammock, what's that 10 look like?
So it hasn't happened in like a while, but before when he'd climb on furniture and start, we would try to put him down on the ground. Then he would try to climb on the furniture. Sometimes like chairs got kicked. It wasn't really throwing too many things. It's more so just as we're trying to take him off of the furniture, he wants to keep climbing it. And then we'll tell him to go and sit down in a chair or calm down in a different area. And then he would get really upset. And so
it's kind of like he's throwing a protest. He's like, I'm going to stand here. I'm going to get my loving or whatever, my physical affection, or I will not move, sir.
When he would smack his like legs and sometimes his head hit, our previous principal had us go in and we would stop him from doing that. We would try to block that, and we've had to put him in holds before if it's gotten too intense.
Oh, okay. And so how frequently does that happen?
It doesn't happen too much anymore, but it was happening more last year.
So the physical holds aren't happening very much, but how frequently are these I don't know. I'm gonna call them protests for now, just as a filler, just as a name for the whole thing. How frequently are his protests occurring?
It doesn't really happen as much, especially since we had the aid. But before that, I just kind of kept him with me all the time, and it just didn't really get to that place as much.
Okay. So I'm having difficulty understanding exactly what the problem is here. So could you mind just being very direct with me? What would you say is the problem?
One, I don't really know where to start with him.
Okay.
As far as actual, like, IEP goals or anything.
Like, what's the thing that you're struggling with? Is it just that he's on top of you guys constantly?
Yeah, we can't get time away from him. There really is no time away from him. And okay, now we have an aide.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's great having an aide. She's basically managing most everything right now. So I can actually like get to my minutes with other kids. But I mean, I think we called you before we were actually able to hire this aide. So.
Okay. So since you've hired the aide, have things changed?
Yeah, we haven't really gotten as upset because they're just kind of together all the time. So he hasn't had to get upset too much. Yeah.
So you've dedicated a person to him, but still there's some social inappropriate clinging going on where it's like a little too physical, a little too intimate,
He's getting touchy. Bigger. He's like 8 now, and beginning of last year was a little bit more reasonable, and now it's not.
Okay, so the problem really is, and what about the self-injury situation? Like, is it like he's hurting himself? What does hurting himself mean exactly? Like, what does that look like?
He'll sit and he'll kind of clench, and he's used to smack his legs and kind of look at you and then do some like head hitting. And then we would rush in and we would try to stop him from hitting himself.
When you say head hitting, is it like he could potentially concuss himself? Or is it more like tapping his head? Like, is there a threat of like self-harm there? Or is it more look like something that would be harmful, but not actually causing damage?
Like it was like he was like
smack.
Yeah, he was slapping the side of his head, but it wasn't like he wasn't like fully putting his arm out. He was just kind of slapping.
Does it leave any marks, any red marks, bruising, irritation of some kind? Does he seem, I don't know, out of it after
he cried when it was going on? So he was pretty red, but we usually tried to rush in before it really got to anywhere that would leave marks.
And that only happens though as a byproduct of this whole process. He doesn't just kind of do it randomly or anything.
No, that was, like I said, that was more last year.
Okay. So you actually haven't seen that recently then?
No.
Okay. Okay. All right. So, wow, we got a lot going on here, huh? This is a tough situation for you guys. Cause I mean, it's hard to get anything done. How many other students are in the room?
There's 4 other students in the room. They're going to arrive here in a little bit, 5 total. Yeah. Okay. If you want, before, you can talk to Carolyn before she goes and gets him off the bus.
Sure. I'd love to hear what Carolyn has to say.
Okay. Cool.
Absolutely, if that'd be okay. Yeah.
Let me go and snag
I'd also love to get Alfonso's point of view at some point too.
You can talk to Al
before, and then maybe get my observation in here.
Perfect. Yeah. Let me know if you need anything.
I very much appreciate it, Neville. It's great work. Thank you for the information.
Hey, Dimitri. I'm Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for taking a second to talk to me. I'd really love to hear what you have to say about Fabio's behavior. Apparently, it's been really giving you guys some challenges. So tell me what's going on. What's your point of view?
First, I used to be a volunteer in AmeriCorps, and I worked more with emotional disability preteen kids. I really liked that time, but I retired, and after a while just realized that I need something to feel like I'm helping out in the world. This job is really a lot, though. It's just so different. In AmeriCorps, it was about winning kids over so they trust you and won't act out in class. I've been trying to win over Fabio and appease him. I heard he will have these episodes where he gets escalated, but I haven't seen them yet. Neville has just warned me about them. So far, he is just this really sweet kid. He's relaxed and really nice. We have done a little bit of work, but honestly, I thought we would be doing a lot more instruction than we are, but again, I'm new here. So far, I have noticed something. If I just pay attention to him a lot, he seems to really enjoy it, and it's creating this really nice bond between us, I think. When we do start some work, I realize that he needs some help to get it done, so I've been giving him some assistance. Between you and I haven't received much direction from anyone about how to work with kids with special needs, so I'm just leaning on my past experiences. The teacher said they use something called a FR3 token schedule, so I've been giving him some tokens for appropriate behavior sometimes. One last thing, because the school bus is pulling up. He really likes to sit on laps. I think it's just awkward and honestly inappropriate he wants to sit on my lap, but the other teachers allow it. And Fabio pursues it a lot. So I've been working on allowing that more and not fighting it as much. Okay, that's the bus. See you later.
Alfonso, what a delight to meet you, sir. Pleasure.
You as well. Thanks for coming.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. So I've got a chance to talk to Neville, and Carolyn gave me a little rundown of her point of view. It sounds like there's definitely something going on here, but it seems like over time it really has kind of diminished in intensity. But it still seems like you guys are having difficulty just getting some separation from Fabio. What is your take on it, just from that administrative perspective? What do you think is going on?
Honestly, I'm not a huge fan of the optics right now.
When you say optics, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the teacher and aide cleared out the classroom due to an intense behavior one day, and the stuff never really went quite back in the classroom. And I mean, we got families walking the halls, and there's just a kid in a room with nothing in it.
I see. So and you just feel
sitting
like
on his teacher's lap.
Okay. That makes a lot more sense now why we're here. So you're basically did you tell him to put it back and they're not, or is it just kind of one of those things where you're waiting to put it back until you figure out a game plan? Because if you put it back, it's just going to cycle all over again, regardless.
I don't have a solution, so I'm letting this run its course. But I'd love some suggestion, because I'd like it to stop as soon as possible.
And how long has the stuff been out of the room?
2 weeks now.
Okay, so it's been about 2 weeks then. So yeah. It finally kind of broke the threshold where you had to clear the room, clear out the room of stuff, et cetera, because he was just standing and relentlessly going after it, hitting himself, and it just became such a kind of scene that it was like, okay, we just have to play contain here and figure it out.
Yeah, this looks bad, but it looks better than it was.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, this is a lot of information. I think I definitely would love to do an observation briefly, if that's okay. And then maybe you and the team and I could sit down and we could kind of maybe troubleshoot and see what we can come up with.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay, phenomenal.
You're seated at the teacher's desk near the front of the room. You see the room is void of most furniture that you'd typically see in a classroom. There are shelves pushed against the back wall, and there are temporary dividers set up between the tables. You see some signage on dividers, some laminated sheets with icons, and some timers. As students arrive, they come in and are directed to put their backpacks away. They come in and sit on the carpet squares near the smart board at the front of the room. Fabio and the aide walk in with their arms linked, and the student is immediately led to a hammock chair near one of the dividers in the back of the room. The students sit and watch a YouTube calendar video with some songs. Fabio is content to swing in his seat as the aide gathers a few activities. The IAS goes over to the classroom rules and gets the other students in the room going on some work. These students sit on the floor and work on little plastic surfaces on their laps. They're working on some worksheets, and the IAS walks around the room. During this time, the aide presents a simple task to Fabio. She attempts to get him out of the chair and points toward the laminated schedule on the wall near them. Fabio sits on the teacher's lap and allows hand-over-hand prompting as magnets are sorted by color. Fabio attends to the work about 15% of the time, you notice, and he is looking up at the aide above him the rest of the time. So you sit in the back of the corner and you notice that this process just kind of keeps repeating outside of scheduled breaks, snack time, lunch time, recess and such. Next thing you know, the bell rings and it's time to get together and sit down with everyone.
All right. Well, thanks for coming together here to debrief about our friend Fabio. So I got a lot of great information from being able to watch you guys do your work. I really appreciate what you're doing here. I really think you're really doing your best in a difficult situation. So there's a couple different things that I want to highlight here that I just still have a few questions about. Mostly it has to do with kind of like what have you actually been doing to intervene other than clearing the room? Has there been any conversation about, because Carolyn mentioned that he was on some kind of FR3, which, I mean, some kind of token economy, I'm guessing. But like, what does that actually mean in terms of the kind of intervention that we're talking about? And also, just other than keeping stuff out of the room and people out of the room, what is the general game plan that you do have going for you?
So with our special ed classes, I like to kind of lean on the teachings of Maria Montessori. My wife's best friend's wife's great grandmother was actually Maria Montessori. So
I was a Montessori kid. That's great. That's wonderful. Love it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, no, I really like the open-ended approach to learning, student-guided learning. We've really tried to let Fabio kind of guide his own learning and education up to this point in some ways. I know that the teachers have their own unique spin on things, but just from an administrative perspective, when I come in, that's kind of how I prefer that the staff organize the classroom.
That's pretty interesting that you implement that methodology in a public school. That's unusual. Is there any limitations to the Montessori method in terms of age range or cognitive capacity or anything like that? I know about it just in terms of what you just described, but I'm not familiar with the technical details.
If I'm being honest, Alfonso and I haven't really necessarily discussed too much of how the Montessori model fits in our room too much. A lot of our conversations were about the more extreme behaviors that we were encountering, and we kind of kept having meetings, and we were able to get Carolyn in here, and things have calmed down a fair amount in the past 2 weeks. But as you kind of mentioned, what are we doing? Where are we going? And I'm pretty good with the structures and how they're work. Like, we have expectations. We have some nice little things from, I've done some like PBIS development in the past year or so, and like, it's working with other students. But I think when you're talking about limitations, I think that Fabio doesn't necessarily fit all the structures that we're using right now.
Okay. Well, oh, there's so much to go through here, folks. So where would you like to start? Where's a good place for you folks to start? Where would you guys like to begin?
Well, if it's okay with you, he does have OT and speech that we kind of were doing before. And I know that the speech conversation has gone to what kind of AAC we want to try to get him on. So I think we have an evaluation coming up soon. Okay. So we're hoping that picks up.
An augmentative device. Okay.
Speech device or something. His family speaks Spanish at home. So I know that's kind of like another little barrier. And then I know in the future, we're going to try to pick up his OT sessions more so. Again, because he has some sensory processing things. So those are kinds of folks that I want to keep in mind as we look at what we can kind of do.
I've actually found him more responsive to Spanish in the classroom. He knows some sign language as well. I mean, it makes sense since that's his first language and the language at home. So I've been kind of switching between Spanish and sign language to figure out which he seems to pick up faster.
Okay, so his first language is Spanish. He does not speak English, or at least whatever English that he may speak is secondary to Spanish. And then additionally, when he does communicate, he's communicating in some kind of ASL. Is there any degree of fluency to it? Is it conversational, or is it just like individual signs and like 1 to 2 sign utterances?
Yeah. Carolyn's been practicing some like what bathroom looks like, and like some more and
more like demanding, more like asking for things to get access to important stuff.
Yeah.
But is he initiating that, or does it need to be prompted?
I think she's usually doing it first and then he'll copy her.
Okay. So I'm like on a bathroom schedule or something, for example.
Yeah. He's on a scheduled bathroom break thing. So he doesn't really ask for that.
Okay.
He
just 30 minutes or an hour.
Yeah. About every half hour.
Okay. So if he doesn't go every half hour, will he potentially have an accident of some kind?
That actually hasn't really been a problem. He's pretty good about going when he's there, and he does fine getting cleaned up. So that
okay. So he's self-sufficient in the restroom then too?
No. We clean him up. He
needs assistance. Okay.
Yeah. He doesn't necessarily have accidents in school too much.
Well, I guess how about this? Before I go, is there any piece of information I should have asked about that you think I need to know before we continue?
The only other thing I can think of is that, like, at home, he lives with his mom and his aunt and a couple cousins, and dad's around occasionally, but doesn't necessarily assist. Sure. So
multi-generational household, very common.
We have a little bit of trouble having consistent communication at home, although Carolyn speaks some Spanish. So on pickup and drop offs, we've actually been, that's been kind of getting better.
You luck out with that, huh? Finding an aide that can fill that gap. That's a tough spot. You guys got very lucky.
We don't want to lose her. Yeah, but I think that's pretty much it for what I'm thinking at right now. It's just we just don't know where to start.
Okay, you don't even know where to start.
So we had a presentation during Teacher Prep Week about the newest release of Proloquo and LAMP, and so we're as a school.
You mean comparing Proloquo to LAMP?
Yes.
Okay. Where are you, the speech and the family, leaning?
We all kind of disagree. Okay. I'm a LAMP guy. Speech wants Proloquo, and the language barriers actually made it difficult to discuss with the family what we think the approach should be.
That's unusual. Usually speech pathologists are very, very partial to LAMP. That's an interesting juxtaposition that you find yourself in. Are you just going to defer then to the speech person, or are you adamant?
I mean, I could be swayed.
Okay. I don't care either way. I'm just more curious. To me, it's all stimuli, but I was just wondering what everyone's preference is. Okay. So there's some disagreement on the communication methodology. And when you say that the family's not really with it, is it more like they don't understand what you're trying to say to them about what it is, or they don't think he needs to use an alternative speech method, alternative communication method?
The language barrier is what's prohibiting us from discussing.
I see. Okay. Well, I'm going to be honest. There's so much here to unpack, folks, that I think that I'm going to need a little bit direction on you and where you would like to start. And I understand that you don't know, but I mean, like, what do we want to start with? Do we want to try to understand what kind of his reality is in terms of how he's like the challenges that he's going to have navigating the world? Do we want to just focus on intervention? Where do you want to begin? Like, give me some kind of thread to pull on here where you'd like to start.
I want his room to look like a classroom again.
Yeah. Okay. If we could talk about what furniture looks like, and that seems to be a driving force right now.
Okay. So basically for you, Alfonso, as an administrator, you just got to get your school looking the way it needs to be looking again. And
you know how it is.
Just in general, Neville, you got to get your classroom back. Right. So right now, Neville, are you splitting time then for your other students if they're in a different room? So you're doing your time, coming in, doing your time, leaving Carolyn with him, and then you're going to another room and working with the other students?
Well, they're mostly in our room for most of the time. I've just been, right now I'm trying to play catch up to get them their SDI minutes, but they go and do specials and stuff out and about in the school. So when they go and do that, I try to kind of get my minutes in with Fabio.
Where are they sitting if there's no furniture? Are they just sitting on their carpet squares?
Yeah, they'll go in their carpet, or they will go over. We have little tables and art tables and stuff by the side that we can go to. But yeah.
Give me like 2 seconds here. Let me just organize my thoughts so I can tackle this, because there's so much going on. And I get that this is hard. I get why it's hard, because, I mean, you got to keep everyone safe. You're not necessarily equipped to handle this level of high magnitude stuff. It's so socially inappropriate on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, it's also tugs at your heartstrings, because he's obviously got some kind of, you know, need, and it's not overtly sexualized or anything like that to make it that level inappropriate, even though a stranger or a non-related adult shouldn't be holding him like that or sitting on the lap. Is that one I don't love, I'm going to be honest with you. Okay, so let's just start with the environment, and then we'll pare down from there. Okay. I think it makes sense that you guys took everything out of the room, honestly, initially. So I think your intuition there was right. More than anything, just to eliminate his capacity to engage in that overall theatrical or scene situation. That sequence of problems. So that's good. I do agree with you that not being able to bring it in is a problem. On the flip side of that, I would say, did you keep the hammock in the room?
Yeah. That stayed in there because he'll sit nicely in that.
Because
that's
your only reprieve.
That's the only time I had away until we got Carolyn. Yeah.
Okay. And it's really great that you were able to find someone who can speak, you know, his native tongue. I mean, that's critical and very culturally sensitive of you. So well played there. I think that's a
New Mexico, man. We got really lucky.
You're in the primo spot, at least, to find someone who can help with that. I think you had a good intuition by pulling everything out. It does make sense that the hammock is still there for now, because you still have to function. And I'm actually really glad that you didn't clear the students out, actually. Most people in this situation would clear the students out, actually, as well. So they would have had them in a situation where you're just working in that room, you have them totally isolated, and then you're going back and forth. However, I do think we're at the point here where we need to just pick a problem, target that specific problem, and kind of build from there. You got to be very careful in these kind of situations not to overcomplicate things and try to do everything at the same time. It's this is one of those things where the elephant needs to be eaten one bite at a time. So just based on your description, I'm going to make an assumption here, and you tell me if I'm wrong. The assumption is that any of the dangerous things or things that we'd be really concerned about in terms of high magnitude disruptive behaviors, jumping on objects or hitting himself, is really just a byproduct of you getting separation from him when he gets clingy. Is that accurate?
That's when we saw it mostly. Yeah.
Mostly, or that's when you saw it? Because mostly changes things.
No, that's basically when we saw it, when we had to pick those battles and fight and try to create that once it got too intense before.
Great. Fantastic. Okay. I will say this, you've done a great job training Carolyn. She's using some excellent terminology. But I think there's some things that we can do there to make it more, less formal and more functional. So, we can kind of get things going where, you know, she can feel a little bit of freedom to be a little more natural with him. So let's just focus on the clinginess, 'cause that's the problem. So let's just really define clinginess here for a minute. Okay. And just really decide what that really looks like. So clingy means he, for whatever reason, goes from playing independently in whatever area is at, most likely it's the hammock. He comes up and he grabs your arm, your body, your waist.
Yeah. He'll kind of go for arm and just assume climbing, like we're going to climb. And then we just kind of pick him up.
You mean climb on you?
Well, he'll like try to get up, and he'll kind of tap your arm and stuff. But if you're not going to make
like a toddler looking to be held like a baby.
Yeah.
Oh, I misunderstood. I thought he was just kind of holding on to you, almost like he just was just nestling in.
When we practice our kind of transitions and walks, we try to have him walk himself, but he'll definitely come and try to climb up on us. Yeah.
Oh my. Is it like this at home?
Yeah,
like, is he very, or his parents very affectionate and like let him, like, does he do this at home with them?
I don't think his cousin, she's older than him, but I don't think she holds him, but I think his mom and his aunt do this. Okay. Which is kind of why we saw that working, and we've tried to have some conversations, but that just ended up, we figured that's what home life was like, so picking that battle here seemed really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're in a tough bind here, because you are going to get what we call behavioral contrast. You're going to see probably a big spike and strengthening and problems, because you're going to be trying to enforce one contingency and there's another one going on in a different environment. But I think it's a battle you got to pick, and it's one you have to fight, and it's one that you have to shape. There's a lot of social reasons for that, and just general maturity reasons for that. I mean, you can't be a grown up walking around hugging people, grabbing them, and wanting to be held by them. And it was cute last year. It's less cute this year. It's going to get real less. It's going to get real uncute when he hits 13, 14, and it's going to be downright scary when he's a grown man with a full beard and mustache, trying to do that to people. And that may be confused as something else in the future. So we probably, like, we really do need to look at this and address it. And we got to fight that battle. My suggestions, I mean, I have a couple of different suggestions. I would say we need to really bring it down to reality in terms of what Carolyn's doing with him. And I think it's great that she's there, but I think we're going to need to simplify things. I'm not really sure what the procedure is for this non-contingent attention situation, and I'm not really sure what the procedure is for this FR, this ratio token system that you're working on. My intuition says drop it, because we're not in a position where we really are in a situation where he doesn't need non-contingent attention. He's perfectly competent at getting attention. What he's not competent at is walking away or letting you withhold your attention. So giving someone non-contingent attention might make sense in a situation where trying to solicit social responding, or you're trying to see if you can clamp down and satiate them on attention. But in this situation, nothing satiates him, because the kind of attention he's seeking is physical attention. He's not just seeking because so unless her non-contingent attention is like some kind of like a hug or something like that, it doesn't really make sense to me. And quite frankly, it's totally inappropriate for his school person to be doing that. I mean, you guys kind of agree with me, or am I off base here?
I think as he's getting older, we know that this has to change, and it's just tough when that separation is what led to those big behaviors that we were dealing with last year.
And I absolutely hear you on how tough it is, but I'm really trying to get to the point here where if our values are aligning here, I mean, from your point of view, do you agree that degree of physical attention, physical touch, and physical contact with a school personnel is inappropriate?
I mean, he's still pretty young.
Okay.
We're teetering on that uncomfortable space though. So I understand what you're talking about, and having been the person that tried to have this kid climbing on me every day constantly, I think that it is a battle worth trying if we have like a plan.
Sure. And Alfonso, I'll tell you what, I'm going to use your words here just to kind of at least maybe clarify my point of view. I think the optics are terrible, frankly. I think the idea of an 8-year-old climbing on a stranger's lap, because even if it's their teacher, they're not relatives. It's a stranger. It's a professional there that's supposed to have professional boundaries, and sitting on their lap during school. I think the optics on that are terrible. And I think that if you're really concerned about optics, that would be a big one I would be thinking about, especially because if you don't start to intervene now, where he's probably a little more physically manageable, it's just going to get harder and harder and more intense as it gets older. And then just wait till he hits 13, 14 and adolescence hits and he's got 1100 nanograms of testosterone rolling through his veins. And that's just going to be recipe for a way bigger problem. And then it also might become sexualized at that point in time, in which case, good luck, buddy, getting it under control. So I'm going to say this. I think we drop all the interventions that you have going on, and I think we just focus on a systematic withdrawal. And what a systematic withdrawal is simply slowly but steadily really imposing a difference and then just doing a neutral redirection to an alternative response that'll give him some physical contact, but more socially appropriate physical contact. In this case, I would suggest some kind of a high five or even a handshake. And just really doing that and taking the time to maybe clear the room for an hour or two, where he is just with Carolyn or just with Carolyn and Neville, or them taking turns and not having anything in there for him to climb around, and literally trying to condition some space, just getting space and then giving that other thing. That would be my suggestion in this situation. Does that kind of like, are you guys following me here and this is starting to make sense or no?
Are we keeping furniture out of the room? Because I feel like he's just going to run and...
Excellent question. That's a fantastic question. So I think this is one of those things where we want to design this in phases. I think we want to start with, can we get physical separation and start to redirect to that alternative response? And that alternative response is going to be that high five, handshake kind of thing with maybe some verbal praise and some really quality attention. So feeding him that eye contact straight into his soul, right? Like just so that he gets really full. And then once you can get 5, 10, 30 seconds, maybe a minute of separation between them, where you can kind of walk a little bit of a distance and come back and kind of get some of this back and forth going, bring in a piece of furniture, repeat the process, and just keep repeating that process over and over again until you keep bringing in pieces of furniture and just run out. And this might be one of those things where you want to do, it might be 2 steps forward, 3 steps back. Where if he does start climbing, remove that furniture again and start over. But the key thing here is maintaining that separation, a physical separation from him as much as possible, and just constantly redirecting. My suggestion would even be really exaggerate that distance, even if you need to break it down that much, to where you'll be standing maybe with your arm out, extended, like soliciting that high five or that handshake. And as he gets closer, really maintaining, using your arm as a way to maintain that socially appropriate personal space. And I would even add, you know, and I actually would say, look this up in Spanish, you know, if that would be, you know, because his first language is Spanish, and maybe establish a verbal rule, like an expectation where you, number one, praise him for staying in his own space. And I don't know what the Spanish phrase would that be, but try to, you know, find out the Spanish phrase for that. And then, or remind him in Spanish, remember, we stay in our, we keep our, stay in your space, stay in your space, stay in your space. And just really focus on that whole distance and stay in your space, stay in your space, and using your arm and that being extended as a way to indicate that's what the safe space is in terms of how you should keep your distance from other people. I know that sounds really arduous and it sounds sweaty and it sounds like it's going to be a ton of work. And I'm going to tell you what it is. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be repetitive, but you're going to get your steps in. Faux show. But we really, really, really need to reset the boundaries, and we really, really, really need to do it in a steady, slow, systematic way, because we don't want to necessarily put him in a situation where we're doing this in a way where he's just going to spike up and have this big problem episode as a result.
You said we could take the rest of the class out for like an hour or two, and I think Carolyn or I, we could switch that, right? Yeah. But are we only doing this for that time, or are we doing this like all day? Like, are we picking that fight all day, or are we just practicing when we can actually keep the kids out of the room so that...
Here's what's tough, okay? Without doing some kind of functional analysis and just kind of looking at this from a functional lens and an analytical lens, and just not really seeing or not really being able to tell if this is really attention or if it's rooted in some semblance of obsession, because that's also possible too. There might be some rigidity and some repetitive and ritualistic nature to this, like related to his ASD or even part of that IDTBI situation, because all these things are kind of the same thing in terms of like his neurological reality. So just assuming that there's some element of that involved going along with the attention, I would say you should do this until you get that separation. If it takes a day, if it takes 2 days, if it takes 3 days, you're going to have to really hold steady and follow through and deal and break through the barrier, break through the wall, because just a little bit of time with something like this, I mean, it might be possible and you might get there, but I'm not sure that you're going to get there in a timely fashion, given your setting, given your resource reality, number of people, and just like limitations of your environment. So I think it's better probably, given because you're in a school and you got these limitations, it's better to just rip off the Band-Aid and go for it.
I got to be honest, I'm not super excited for that.
Yeah, man. But I hear you.
I guess that's what we're going to do.
I mean, you don't have to, of course, but that's my inclination is to tell you to do that is what I would say.
Okay.
Because I just don't see any other way of breaking this and really getting into something else. I'm sorry?
What are we going to do about our other students?
Alfonso, I would ask, like, do you have an additional room or an unoccupied room or a space that they can maybe go and do their work and other activities just temporarily while you do this?
Yeah, but then we're putting one half of our staff on one quarter of our students
in that classroom, you mean, right?
Yeah,
well, theoretically you were already working 1-on-5 until you got Carolyn, right?
Yeah,
so now you'd be working 1-on-4 with Carolyn or the teacher being 1-on-1, so you actually just improved your ratio and you were able to get intensive 1-on-1 intervention going on, so you're actually better off now.
Good point.
Awesome. Really great talking with you guys. I'll tell you what, I would be happy to come in and model this for you, because what I just described is a really difficult intervention. And if you do approve some hours for me, Alfonso, I'd love to come. I'd be happy to come in for a couple hours and kind of walk you guys through it, demonstrate and coach you through it and fade out and stuff, so you can really get into a groove and figure it out. And we can do it together. And then kind of slowly fade myself out from there. So if that would also be there, I'd be happy to help out with this directly, because I think it's just going to make sense too. Because it's an easy thing for me to describe. It's a difficult thing to execute, and it's going to really require some hands on from me, I think, to really get you guys there.
But if before we can get you here again, I know we do have that evaluation coming up for his AAC, and I just wanted I was curious if you had like input that we should tell his speech pathologist about what we can be doing with him for that.
Well, here's the thing. I would never presume to tell another professional how to do their job, but I would say this. I'd ask her if it makes sense for things to be in Spanish, because if he's using an AAC, given where he's functioning, it's all going to be pictures anyway. So, I mean, it could be in Spanish and you guys could be able to still assist him and navigate it by looking at the icons themselves. So that would be my suggestion, just to be considerate of his linguistic situation. But I mean, like, other than that, are you asking me, do we need to wait for the AAC? Do we need to wait for the device to start this because of me talking about the verbal rule, or what exactly you're asking me here?
Well, you were scrapping his schedule, but we've been trying to use those pecs like next to him for him to try and do things. And I just don't know if we're getting rid of those, like if we can keep those or if we're,
you can definitely keep them, but here's what I'm going to say. You're not really getting through the schedule right now functionally if he's chasing you around, because you're trying to get a little bit of physical separation from him, right?
Yeah.
So the question is the schedule, is he doing anything with the schedule other than it just being there? And is it guiding his day in any way? Or is it just a preventative and a tool and a thing that you've become accustomed to and it's a box that you're checking? Because if it's a box that you're checking, I mean, I love checking boxes with the best of them, but we're here to do something real and functional, and box checking isn't what we're here to do.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Okay. Phenomenal. So maybe I'll see you guys tomorrow and we'll get rolling.
See you then.
Perfect. Stupendous. See you later. Marvelous.
You made it. This is the point in which you can pause. Think about what you maybe would have done differently. Think if there's any themes throughout this as well. We're going to break character here and this just turns into a typical podcast where it's just an open discussion. I hope you enjoy.
That is a weird case.
It is.
I think I've worked with a clingy kid or two, actually, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I didn't.
Go ahead.
I didn't think the case was that out there, honestly.
No.
Maybe the Montessori
thing. You didn't think the Montessori. You guys did that to try to make me to laugh.
Like, Maria, you got to get one in every episode.
I know. That's such a you thing, dude. Oh,
I didn't write it. Though,
I was legit a Montessori kid. I did Montessori when I was a kid.
Legit taught success at a Montessori story, school. Man. That's perfect. Hey,
they crushed it, man. I'm a wild animal. I'm unbound by social convention. Just what the world needed. I mean, it wasn't a tough case in terms of like what you would do in a clinical setting, but I think the caveat of it being in a school made it really hard.
Right? Which is pretty realistic. I want to say is that you have kids that can kind of navigate different environments, and they might end up in a unit that isn't prepared, where maybe their interventions are working for the majority of kids, but for one big outlier, it can be a little bit outside their depth.
And you can have like some extremely passionate folks that fall in those aid roles, and then you still got, you know, someone that's also green, you know, mm-hmm. So like a lot of experience, but they're usually thrown in there. It was purposely
Carolyn talked really about a very
She couldn't catch a break. I mean, it seems like the other teachers were kind of caving into it, and she's trying to put in place like an extinction procedure on her own, and then she ultimately caves to it, and it just
it's
a dumpster fire.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it was, a dumpster fire. Oh man, I mean, I'm just trying to think, where was the red herring in this? Were you guys trying to throw me off with SIB?
You dug into that, but that was more just to let you know that we're trying to that Neville was kind of appeasing and avoiding the extreme thing. So almost his interventions had been put on extinction a little bit because the will won for Fabio.
ASD, ID, and TBI.
Yeah, let's create a few areas here to discuss maybe and pick your poison. We can drop these if we need to, but communication modalities, I think you handled that in a very appropriate way. Those were a mess because everyone was advocating for something different.
Yeah.
So what's some common, common situations that he ran us into?
This is a tough, honestly, I was torn on the communication modality for a couple different reasons. I tried to kind of point that out subtly, but you had your details wrong. The speech paths are always going to push Prentice Romy, which is the lamp. Because, I mean, I'm pretty sure they get kickbacks for that program or something, or it's just what they learn in college and that's what they're into. They really don't like the proloquos of the world and stuff, even though I think the proloquos you know, for $200, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck there compared to $7,000 for a handheld device with a piece of software on it, or $10,000 in some cases. So, like,
I think in addition to that, we should be, I mean, if we're looking at managing this behavior, and it could get intense, I wouldn't want to put a couple $100 device in the classroom until we work through it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the way you guys were answering my questions, it really didn't indicate to me that the property destruction was that severe, though.
I didn't think it was, as Neville.
You kind of downplayed it, and I just took your word for it.
Yeah, because it's the furniture was a mechanism, and the furniture was probably the main property in play for really just forcing our hand to engage in physicality.
Right. That's what I mean, though. Like, so it's like his shenanigans were not about breaking stuff or hurting people. His shenanigans were, if you won't love on me, I'll make you love on me.
That is correct.
You can have the mango, you know, like, which is makes total sense. So I don't know. I don't know if he would actually do that, but actually that's a great point though. I will say this, Max, that's a fair point to bring up. Like, do you want to give him basically a weapon, and not only a weapon, but an irreplaceable weapon that's tens of thousands of dollars, or that's thousands of dollars, and it takes, if it breaks, it takes 90 days to mail it in and get it back in 2023, which is absurd, right? That's a fair critique.
How did you get to the point of where you wanted to start? Like, why did you select the making some space?
I mean, because that's the problem. The problem is you can't get space, so get space. I mean, when all else fails, Occam's razor, man. The simplest explanation is usually the right one, right? It was just like, what's the problem? That's the problem. Well, then, if anything, the most obvious solution to a hard problem is to do the opposite of that thing, because that's the way that you start to at least find a place to unwind. Now, to be fair, I don't know if what I just said would work, okay? Especially given the competency levels that you see in a school setting. But at least it would have given them a place to start trying to build those boundaries, which is what's part of it, and getting some of that separation and starting thinking for alternative responses that actually make sense, right? Because if we're even thinking about if, for example, the whole point of his prom behavior was for you to get up and give him physical attention, but you're giving him an NCA, a non-contingent attention thing, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, why not just make it contingent attention and the kind of attention he's actually seeking out, which is physical attention. Now, granted, it's not going to be the magnitude that he's probably seeking out, right? Because a high five is not the same as cuddles. But that's also where sometimes, and that's why I kept trying to push for that social appropriateness thing when I was having that dialogue with them. Sometimes it doesn't matter, you know, sometimes you have to deal with an extinction burst as part of a process, because some things are just so socially inappropriate, you have to withdraw them. Like, there's no systematic, gentle way to not inappropriately touch another person's kid. It's a zero or one. You're either doing it or you aren't. So in this situation, you shouldn't be. So the answer is you don't do it. So the only option you have is an extinction procedure of some kind. Now, this is what I described, at least the intention behind it, was an attempt to diminish the effects or the possible side effects of what that extinction procedure should be, which would be the burst. So minimize the severity of it. But I mean, to me, at least, maybe that's just me bleeding in my own values to the situation, but I have some hard lines, and like, some of my hard lines are sexualized behavior and social appropriate touching or anything like that, therapeutic touching, whatever. It needs to be very tightly monitored and very tightly engaged in a way that doesn't break very hard red lines. And the idea of a child sitting on a person's lap, at an 8-year-old, and to me, an 8-year-old is pretty old, actually. Second grade, going into third grade, that's a pretty old kid in terms of like sitting on a grown-up's lap.
I thought you made some good points there too, that if even if someone doesn't like thinking that way initially, that it is something that as that continues to progress, just ultimately gets more and more awkward, inappropriate, or potentially just escalates, right?
Absolutely. And that's the other thing too, is that, I mean, the function, and that's the thing is that, you know, we don't think about this stuff a lot of the time, but we don't think about what are the long-term consequences of us choosing to diminish how big of a problem a thing is over time. And someone could argue, oh, that's slippery slope thinking. But I mean, I've spent my career working with all the kids who were the result of that slippery slope that never got addressed. So I'm like, maybe I'm a little more sensitive to it. But I, again, like some categories of behaviors are so difficult to intervene the longer and longer they go and the older and older a person gets, that if it's starting to get real untangled, real messy, the sooner the better. And a sexualized behavior in particular, I can say this, the biggest failure of my career clinically was it related to a sexualized behavior. It was a compulsive masturbation scenario that I tried to disrupt and intervene and try to alter. And I mean, I was unsuccessful in intervening in that in the most controlled setting, that with the best trained people, with all the environmental contextual capacity to do whatever I wanted to do in any way that was possible. And I still couldn't get to it because, you know, he was too old and too rigid and too strong and too hormonally compelled. And it's like, so I'm also maybe a little sensitive to that, just like thinking about my experience. But I mean, again, like, we have to think about these things long term, and we have to think about kind of how these things evolve into other things if we don't. And rigidity in particular is like, I always describe it to people as like the Ouroboros of problem behavior. It's the snake. It's the infinite snake that eats its own tail. And it just keeps winding itself tighter and tighter to infinity. If it's not disruptive or altered, and it becomes more and more confounding over time because it's allowed to kind of fester and create bizarre stimulus relations that are literally impossible. It have infinite relations that are impossible to unwind. So you got to be very careful of those scenarios.
You mentioned the failings in one of the most controlled clinical environments in which you've been. Well, what does it look like? Because you brought it up a little bit of, hey, pick your battles at school, but when 2/3 of this individual's day, they're at home with individuals that feed into the behavior or allow the behavior. And now we're choosing just at this specific location to intervene. So we're not going to do the holding.
Yeah, that's a fair anymore. Point. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, again, this is another reason why I would advocate for a clear extinction procedure. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, this isn't a situation where you want to go to punishment. And I just use the word punishment. I'm sure anyone listening to this just cringed because I dared to say the word that will not be said out loud and named, right? Whatever, Lord Unishperp. But I mean, like, it's a thing that, like, and now extinction's kind of starting to be put in that category. But I mean, like, you have to have some stuff needs to get stopped in its tracks. There's no soft approach to these things for some things. Because, and especially in a situation where you're going to see those contrasting contingencies and competing contingencies across environments, you need to create a very clear environmental discrimination. Setting discriminations. That's what you're teaching and conditioning to, right? To discriminate social conduct in one setting versus what's appropriate social conduct in another setting. And in order to shape that behavior in that way, you have to establish the contingency and follow through with it unequivocally. Because if you provide any degree of intermittent reinforcement or like variability in that, in the setting that you're trying to create the discrimination against where it's not appropriate, you're muddying the waters. And if you're muddying the waters, you're strengthening the behavior. That's what we know. So it's critical to really I just think it's critical to focus on the fact that it's a setting discrimination. You're going to have to deal with contrast, which means you're going to deal with a burst. And yeah, bursts suck, but it's like gravity, dude. I mean, extinction bursts are quantitatively like gravity. They're inevitable. You can do your best to soften them And if they are ever going to breach a threshold that is dangerous, you want to second guess yourself in terms of whether or not it's the right intervention. But in this situation, given what's going on, I think it would be in those manageable levels where it would have been annoying, frustrating, and difficult, but not necessarily dangerous or hazardous to anybody's health. And that's the kind of risk, brief kind of risk calculus you have to do on the fly.
From a classroom management perspective, I know that the suggestion was it might take a couple days. We have the aide and teacher rotate throughout. Going through, it seems like the hammock kind of had the ability to pacify the behavior. Do you think that having some sort of model where they do this extinction burst treatment for the time when the other students are in specials and then had non-contingent access to the hammock available during classroom time could still see similar results as long as there was a criteria to remove the classroom and resume going through the burst if the child began to engage in the behavior even with the hammock present?
What do you think?
I mean, I'm trying to look at it from a classroom management perspective. It makes me think back on running the ISCA back when we used to do it, and just kind of having those dedicated times where this is what we're doing, and then outside of it we were
doing the SPT protocol or whatever. Yeah FCT tolerance stuff.
Yeah, and then we just drop
you're
it when we're
dedicated
not
dedicated targeted time to- why not just do dedicated targeted time like the Hanley protocol versus ripping the band-aid off and just going hardcore.
Yes.
It's basically, and you think that it could be equally effective. Is that what you're saying?
I'm posing a question, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm asking, I mean, dude, you know, you're a smart guy. You're good at this. I mean, what do you think? I want to know what you think.
I mean, I think it would really depend on if the hammock was able to successfully pacify the behavior.
Yeah, I don't like the word pacify. I think the fact that you're using the word pacify is a problem.
I honestly think that the situation in which the school could potentially have Dimitri for the following 3 days makes it more likely that we're going for the full Band-Aid rip, as opposed to if I'm touching base with the school and trying to give them a more palatable intervention for individuals who are less likely to be successful being hands-on, then almost a little bit more of the approach Max is talking about seems... It may not be as effective as going full blown, but having someone observe and coach you through and guide you through in smaller bites is better than nothing. I think it's like it's a medium space, but I think if you have that person there and they're willing to help and assist and model immediately, then I think you can go in a little bit more full blown.
I think in a school setting, I think the key phrase was the principal, the administrators were like, get my building back to normal. And I think the idea of the Hanley protocol, SBT, whatever, it's a fantastic protocol. Let me just start there. It's amazing. The ISCA is a masterpiece in my opinion, in terms of conceptually systematic thinking of complex reinforcers and complex actual behavior in time put into a procedure that people don't really understand or appreciate why it's brilliant. Okay, I want to start there. Secondly, I want to say that the FCT tolerance denial phased in the way it's in. It's a brilliant protocol. It's beautiful. It works amazingly in a lot of great situations, especially in rigid, repetitive, ritualistic behavioral problem situations. However, in the situation like this, there's one aspect of the protocol that would be a problem, and that's if there's resistance, drop it and go back to business as usual until the next session. That's the protocol, right? So in this situation, he would immediately resist. So you should drop it every time. So even if you try to do it 30 times throughout the day and you set 10-minute intervals on an hourly basis for a 6-hour school day, so you're going to allow yourself 6 opportunities to do 6 micro sessions, which is actually a thing that would be recommended within the protocol, depending on the severity of the behavior. That's not a crazy thing for me to say, right? The second you start your thing and you get that resistance, you drop it, and he's just latching on. What are you actually doing in this situation? You're intermittently reinforcing the behavior you're dropping, and you're not actually creating any tolerance moments or instances. So, like, I don't know. I would say if it was rigid and repetitive ritualistic behavior, given the reality of it, it might make sense. I think the social component of it and that physical touch aspect of it being the thing, I think you got that social, it goes back to me again. For me, it goes back to that social appropriateness metric, that social appropriateness judgment. That social appropriateness piece to me was a design extinction procedure, eliminate that as fast as humanly possible and then get back to business as usual, not slowly make him okay with, you know, dealing with not being able to touch inappropriately.
Do you think that there could have been some possible benefits or like accidental landmines that you step on if you were to be looking at it as like a synthesized reinforcer approach? Because I could see people potentially focusing just on that aspect and being like, what if we actually increase the amount of opportunities that we're providing someone like him, Fabio, to be able to just get as much as this attention as humanly possible more and more and more?
Well, I mean, as of right now, he's hugging people, you know, 90% of the time, right? So what's the difference between 90 and 100? The 10% differential versus 90 to 0, which is 90. So, I mean, like, if we're looking at this in a logarithmic chart, the distance to go down versus the distance to go up is proportionally not the response effort and just consequences of that differences in degrees is too great, in my opinion. And the other thing too is that, just to be clear, I conceptualize everything as a synthesized reinforcer. I don't really buy, I think isolated functions is, you know, I think that's passe. I think we've grown past these things. It's just such
a byproduct of our linear teaching programs.
Right.
It's so unfortunate. Like, it was never a single A, a B, and a single C. Like, it never was. But it was for the sake of us trying to make a simple model, and it was conveniently the first three letters of the English alphabet. Like,
well, it makes sense. It makes sense when you're trying to break down behavior at T plus one, T plus two, T plus three. And you're like modulating it like molecularly like that, right? That's the problem with a molecular model of analysis behavior. Like, you look for T plus one, T plus two, T plus three, and you create this idea where behavior isn't occurring in a river of time. It's occurring in a motion picture style where you have a frame occurring over time. And that's wrong, right? It's continuous. It's not a frame that just, it's not like a motion figure where it's like frames that look like things moving in continuity. They actually are streaming in direct continuity. And that's a difficult, philosophically and conceptually, unless you like psychedelics, it's a really hard idea to get to on your own. So, I mean, like, it's a tough bridge to cross at certain points in my mind conceptually, to like actually be able to close your eyes and feel that, you know, not just like understand it as an exercise, intellectual exercise.
Other than me wanting to ask on a scale of 1 to 10 how much you enjoyed the names in today's case, I also want to know if the TBI component really played anything in your decision making, or if that is just a factor that was on the medical diagnosis and does not, no impact.
I mean, the TBI to me was a reason for the ID, not its own thing. Because, I mean, the side effects or the impact that a TBI would have on a person usually would be diminished intellectual functioning, right? So you would have a lower IQ, lower cognitive capacity, or you would have some limitations in physical activities. I mean, you know, motor functions, gross or fine. In this case, so I just assumed that the ID, it was more like TBI, ID, TBI ID related or TBI related ID is how I like translated it. So the TBI was just kind of like, okay, that explains there was some traumatic experience that created the TBI. And, you know, for me, in terms of like, again, going back to this idea of determining or distinguishing between critical and non-critical variables, as a critical variable, the effects of the TBI are what mattered, which was the ID, which talked about, you know, what is the processor speed and like, what is his capacity to, you know, take in information and act on that in any shape or form, not necessarily the TBI itself.
Cool.
I mean, do you think that's a kosher way to look at it, or is that how you would have figured?
Yeah, I see individuals with whom I don't know, I just encounter sometimes that a diagnosis can be a limiting factor in what my expected returns are, or it can be that same circular reasoning you're talking about. Well, the rocking, the need is this diagnosis. This diagnosis is leading to that need that they have right now. And I think that it's like not a slippery slope, but it can definitely be like someone could discount gains to be made. And even Neville probably in this case was not very optimistic about many gains being made. Potentially they were not seeing success with their methods with this student in particular. So it was chalked up potentially to diagnosis.
Yeah. This is one of those times where oddly enough, the diagnoses were less important than I think, other than the intellectual disability, because I think that kind of framed out the communication for me, honestly. So it's like, that was more like where is his social capacity at? So to what degree can he exchange information with other people? Because that's really the limiting factor of this, right? How can I, like, what is the degree of sophistication of information exchange from, you know, one person to another to be able to effectively get, you know, what you want from another human being so you can identify, function, or figure it out, the desire that the person has. But other than that, honestly, it was more, this would be a lot more, to be frank, this to me would be a lot more of a staff training classroom protocol problem than it really is a thing with the person. Because this is the kind of behavior that usually emerges as a result of just poor boundaries, poor expectation setting, and poor follow through. So none of this stuff is actually Fabio's fault in my mind. You know, this would be like he had grownups that didn't know or didn't realize how critical it is to have some clear cut boundaries, expectations, and rules that matter, and to really push those.
Yeah, and the fresh eyes in the class of Carolyn coming in kind of noticed that at first, right? Like, I don't think this is normal, right? But it kind of seems to be what should be normal here, based on the culture.
But she still gave into it, though, because she was letting him sit on her lap and stuff, though. So there was still, she started kind of getting
slid into the culture, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I think it was devastating. I think when I don't know what her exact wording was, but even like I relent or I give up, right? And it was just like, oh God, you relent. That's devastating.
We're going to have to talk about the Hanley protocol, or I'm going to talk about me talking about an extinction procedure. Cause I mean, like I can imagine there being some reactivity to the idea that I would advocate for an extinction procedure. But I mean, like I don't think it's a dirty word. I think it's a reality of behavior. So, you just got to cut it off, you know?
I get to introduce the topic to a bunch of master's students in a class, and I've always tried to make it really clear that there is a constant extinction all over the place that you experience in your day-to-day life. I mean, like, you choose the wrong key to put in a door and you can't get through the door. like it's little things like that, that I think largely are forgotten by a lot of behavior analysts. And obviously it's different when you're deciding what intervention do I put in here. But like you brought it up earlier, you can't make a discrimination without having an S delta condition. Exactly. Like there is a reinforcer. There's always an S delta condition. So I think some of this comes down to, dare I say, like the art of how you implement these sort of things, right? And the safety aspect that you brought up there, and that's just not being talked about nowadays. And if you can get there without having to implement some sort of harsh procedure, cool. But like we've totally forgot, like I said, we just totally forgot that there's always an S delta condition. Always.
We have to think about the impact that the interventions have on people, and we have to think about emotional reactivity. And we have to think about the kind of fallout stuff. But we also have to remember that procedures are amoral. Not immoral, amoral. As in they don't adhere to a positive or negative moral framework. They're neutral. Punishment is neutral. It's an effect. It's a decreasing behavior relative to a stimulus. It's It's not bad. It just is. Reinforcement is an increased behavior relative to stimulus. It's not good. It just is, right? Extinction is a determination of a behavior's accessing a particular reinforcer. That's not bad. It just is. And we know that the response to those stimulus conditions are predictable, especially with extinction, right? We know that there's going to be a burst. It's being able to recognize the strength of the response and kind of take in all the information and anticipate the severity of the burst or the intensity and magnitude of the burst, and if you can manage it or not. I mean, you have to be willing. And I actually don't like that I'm calling this a risk, but I think given people's points of view and kind of the discourse, I should say, I mean, you have to be able to take calculated risks. But that's why we do things like risk assessments or risk analyses. That's why those procedures and protocols are there too, is that you have to weigh, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly to be able to make a decision, because no choice that we make is perfect. There's always going to be a degree of uncertainty. And if there's uncertainty, there's risk.
And every choice that you make. When you take it out of that snapshot ABC piece and you look at the long picture, are the risks going to get greater, or are they going to decrease over time as this individual starts having more hormones, starts having those sexualized behaviors you talked about? So that kind of comes down to, do we do it now or do we do it later? And if it's more palatable for those involved and more manageable and more likely to be successful, then it might just be that that's the tipping scale of, okay, maybe we do address this procedure, do this protocol.
Yeah, man. Because I mean, like, you guys have been there. I know that. I mean, we've done it together. 17-year-old with bodybuilder levels of testosterone naturally flowing through their veins, trying to get any kind of rigid, repetitive, ritualistic behavior disrupted or redirected. Forget disrupted or interrupted. Just redirected. And the degree of explosivity that can go with that. I mean, the consequences to me are dire. And not to mention the family circumstances that result in that. Like, I also go back to quality of life questions, because that's another one that is like, if we're going to make an ethical decision, if there's ethical objections that would come here. And I think that this is a perfect time to be like, you know, if you're in the audience, this is where you should interject. We'd love to hear your opinion, and you should kind of give your thoughts on this. But I would say that, you know, thinking quality of life questions should factor into these things. Because people don't live in a vacuum. We just mentioned that this person lives in a multi-generational household, tons of relatives. Like, what is the impact on those people too? They deserve a high quality of life. I mean, they're his caretakers, they're his caregivers. And if they've made the commitment to stick with him through thick and thin, and keep him at home, I mean, again, going back to that whole social behavior is a two-way street. And, you know, having an intellectual disability or some kind of special need obviously grants you exceptions to so many social conventions. I don't think it's a complete pass on reasonable contingencies and reasonable social appropriate expectations and the ability to kind of give people their space too. And this is one of those things where, I mean, if he's doing that to his teachers, what's it look like at home? Is he just like literally like a koala bear on his mom? At 8 years old, what kind of life is that poor woman living? You know,
it's a life of back problems. Yeah,
exactly. You know, like his sister or his grandma, like aside from it looking bizarre from the outside, I mean, that's not fair to anybody. I think you have a moral obligation to intervene on those kinds of problems. I just do.
Hey, Dimitri, we're still trying to work on the intervention that you recommended. We were able to get some of the furniture back in the room for the other students, and we spent those dedicated days where we really worked on setting those limits and those neutral redirections. I'm actually able to hit a few more targets with my other students, and I think that we're all a little bit less stressed out in the room right now. It seems like Alfonso and Carolyn are doing a little bit better with this as well right now. So just want to say thank you, and we'll touch base next month.
Your code word if you're interested in earning BACB CUs is Molar and Molecular Behavior Analysis. Again, if you're interested in earning BACB CUs, your code word is Molar and Molecular Behavior Analysis. Head over to explanatoryfiction.com, purchase the quiz, complete the quiz, and then your CUs are sent to you automatically. Again, if you're interested in earning BACB CUs, your code word is Molar and Molecular Behavior Analysis. The views expressed during the Explanatory Fiction podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of any position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice. Remember again that the variables in this case were randomly generated, as well as the name and the episode imagery. Thank you, math. Thank you, science. And thank you, artificial intelligence. Rhino LLC is an approved continuing education provider that is ACE number hashtag OP-19-3037, and the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, also known as the BACB, the registered trademark, does not sponsor or approve or endorse Rhino LLC, the materials, information, or sessions identified herein. Thank you for listening.